Greetings and Monolavian sequestrations, my topotropically Yorubian listeners, and welcome to this July 2018 Science News Update. I'm your host for this masochistically cute science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Okay, ladies and germs, this is it. It's been 10 years in the making. This is the 10th anniversary of the Science News Update. I've been doing this nonstop each month for a whole decade. Yes, that means, if you're counting, that this is update 120. Starship Sofa has been going for longer than my podcast segment, but not by very much. After 10 years of doing this, I think I need to start reevaluating how much longer I will do it. And I enjoy doing the podcast, I enjoy finding the stories. Forces me to keep up to date on the latest science that's out there in all sorts of different fields. However, it does take up quite a bit of my limited time. The bad part about the podcast is that I do it even when I literally don't have the time for it, because I have an abnormal need to do what I have promised when I feel obligated, which means writing and reading and recording into the late evenings sometimes. I have my own scientific manuscripts to complete, plus a half-written novel which has lain dormant for months, and my bookcast, which takes a huge amount of time for recording and editing. How can I do all this, plus be there for my family? It's getting harder. We will see what happens in the coming months. My guess is that Tony wants to continue the Starship Sofa long into his retirement. I'm not sure I can continue to contribute for that length of time, but we shall see. Okay, first story of the night is about idiot scientists. Yes, not one, but hundreds of idiot scientists. In the online journal Plus One, Dr. Sergei Horbach from Radboud University in the Netherlands has reported on the impact of misidentified cell lines in biomedical literature. His group discovered that it reaches far further than anybody had anticipated. It started a few months ago with HeLa cells and long discussions about cell line contamination and experimental reproducibility. You may remember, thank you Oprah, that HeLa cells are from an immortal cancer cell line started in the early 1950s from a woman named Henrietta Lacks. Well, there have been a few methodological problems with many experiments published over the last few years because the researchers doing the work mislabeled cells that were supposed to be HeLa cells, or they did not identify HeLa cells correctly. It turns out, unfortunately, that HeLa cells are not the only culprits for contamination, and the contamination is not restricted to the laboratory. Misidentified cell lines litter the scientific literature. Then what happens is that those studies get cited, and it sort of spreads like a contamination, sort of like a meme. What happens is that you get this information contamination beyond the original study. It's a problem. Horbach says, quote, "There's quite some effort in trying to avoid new and future cell line contaminations, but there seems to be very little attention for all the research articles that are already out there that people are still building their research on." Unquote. To look into this problem, Horbach began with a list of 451 misidentified cell lines from the International Cell Line Authentication Committee. He classified papers describing research using these cell lines as primary papers and papers citing that research as secondary papers. Horbach then searched for papers reporting the first establishment of different cell lines on the online cell line database, Cellosaurus, and confirmed the data using three additional cell line databases. He next combed through the literature listed in the Web of Science database for papers referencing the establishing articles, the original articles that talked about these cell lines. In parallel, he also used the Web of Science database to search for the misidentified cell line names in paper titles, abstracts, and keywords. With these combined approaches, Horbach found 32,755 research articles that relied on misidentified cell lines. Approximately 90% of those papers were also cited at least once in other papers, further propagating the initial inaccuracies. These numbers came after Horbach verified the establishing articles and excluded cell lines with names that are not unique identifiers from the overall analysis. Because of this dataset trimming, Horbach suspects that these numbers are actually conservative estimates. He thinks that more than 500,000 papers rely on misidentified cell lines. Horbach does note that we must all understand that using misidentified cell lines does not necessarily nullify a study. For some projects, the actual cell line is of little importance, as the researchers are studying general characteristics of cells. That, however, does not reduce the problem of the scientific literature contamination, as Horbach has called it. He's very worried about the state of cell biology and the reputation of scientists. He says, quote, "The fact that biologists do not address this as a community is really, really worrisome. I think scientists praise themselves about being objective and try to do things carefully. This is not the state of the art of standard practiced procedures that we should be applying. We should do much better," unquote. Cell line misidentification has infiltrated research over the years and affected countless studies. These cannot be removed from the literature, making it hard to address the problem. In addition to annotating already published papers, Horbach therefore advocates for transparency for cell culture-based studies instead. First, researchers should be aware if their cells are misidentified and disclose, quote-unquote, an expression of concern in future research papers. Second, to facilitate future studies, like Horbach's current study, scientific research papers should clearly include information about cell lines in a searchable portion of the paper, that is, the title, the abstract, or the key words. Horbach concludes with, quote, "Primarily, we'd like to work together more in depth with the people in the field, so biomedical scientists and cell biologists, and then also to consider how much scientific conclusions or to what extent conclusions have been affected by the use of misidentified cells," unquote. Next story. What is a male mouse, not a male mouse? Well, it turns out that the removal of a small section of non-coding DNA may help to explain why mammals with XY chromosomes can develop ovaries instead of testes. Now, geneticists have known about this in part previously. This is not new. This is a phenomenon called sex reversal, which I lecture about in my medical genetics class. And if either a gene on the Y chromosome is lost, which I'll tell you about in a second, or another gene on the non-sex chromosome is lost, then you may have an XY female developing. Why is this new and amazing? Well, it has to do with the fact that no gene is being lost or mutated in these instances. It is, in fact, a small, non-coding regulatory region of DNA. Let me explain. Dr. Robin Lovell-Badge of the Francis Crick Institute in London has shown in the journal Science that male mice can grow ovaries as opposed to testes, but a small region of non-coding DNA is removed. Now, 98% of your DNA, 98% of a mouse's DNA for that matter, is non-coding. That means that it doesn't make proteins. But it's only about 2% of your DNA that has genes that actually make proteins. However, non-coding sections of DNA are increasingly believed to be more important than was initially given credit for. At a particular embryonic developmental stage, the SOX9 protein initiates the transformation of the sex organs into testes and guides the rest of the embryo to become male. The amount of SOX9 protein is controlled by the SRY gene. Now, the SRY gene is encoded on the Y chromosome. Hence, males usually develop testes as long as they have a Y chromosome, even though the SOX9 gene is in the female genome. Females don't get it turned on because there's no SRY gene. Way back in 1991, researchers demonstrated that a female XX mouse, who was named Randy, strangely enough, developed male sex organs after the introduction of the SRY gene during embryonic development. So again, if the SRY is present, you get a male. So if there is not enough of that SOX9 protein, mammals with XY chromosomes will develop ovaries. Hence this idea of sex reversal. Lovell Badge demonstrated that a small piece of non-coding DNA called ENH13, enhancer 13, boosts the production of the SOX9 protein in order to trigger testes development. When enhancer 13, which is over 500,000 base pairs away from the SOX9 gene on the same chromosome, was removed by the researchers, the male XY mice developed ovaries instead of testes. Yes, even though it is 500,000 base pairs away, it can have a major effect on development and determine if the mouse will be male or female. Lovell Badge says, quote, "We think enhancer 13 is probably relevant to human disorders of sex development and could potentially be used to help diagnose some of these cases. It may be that a great many mysterious sex reversal events in humans will now be explained," unquote. She finishes with, quote, "Our study also highlights the important role of what some still refer to as junk DNA, which makes up 98% of our genome. If a single enhancer could have this impact on sex determination, other non-coding regions might have similarly drastic effects. For decades, researchers have looked for genes that cause disorders of sex development, but we haven't been able to find the genetic cause for over half of them. Our latest study suggests that many answers could lie in the non-coding regions, which we will now investigate further," unquote. Going forward, Lovell Badge's team is investigating other enhancers involved in the regulation of SOX9 and other sex-determining genes, and hopes to also understand how SOX9 expression is repressed in females, leading to the development of ovaries. Now, along the same lines, we seem to think that since a large proportion of our genome does not code for proteins, then, well, that DNA must not do anything useful. And in fact, some of that DNA may be kind of harmful. A lot of the so-called junk DNA, which does nothing at all, remember we're talking 98% of the genome, but there are other bits that literally move around in our genomes. These are called transposons. Barbara McClintock won her Nobel Prize years ago for discovering these jumping genes, as they've been dubbed. And for years, she was made fun of because, well, nobody believed they actually existed. Anyway, it turns out that some of these transposons that seem to do nothing and are potentially harmful are absolutely needed for mouse embryo development. A type of transposon called line 1 is absolutely required to continue mouse development past the 2-cell stage. This was reported in the journal Cell on July 7th. Dr. Miguel Ramalho Santos of the University of California in San Francisco found this out. Many scientists insist that these nasty, selfish genetic elements that jump around the genome make mutations and wreak havoc, but it appears that the jumping genes, at least this one in particular, is more helpful to development than previously thought. Yeah, it does sound kind of scary. I mean, transposons can hop into the middle of DNA, break genes, and cells deploy numerous tools to prevent those genes from making RNA and protein copies in themselves. But in early development, line 1 is turned on nearly to full blast, packing tons of RNA into the embryonic cells, as well as germline cells, which later give rise to eggs and sperm. Ramalho Santos says, quote, "Having active transposons potentially hopping around such vital cells could be dangerous. The phrase playing with fire comes to mind. If anything, embryos and germline cells should be among the cells most heavily guarded against transposons and their dangerous effects," unquote. To see what the jumping gene, line 1, was doing in the cells, Ramalho Santos's team used a short piece of RNA that could pair up with the line 1 RNA and cause the transposon to be degraded, essentially turning off the jumping gene. So if you've been following the podcast over the last few months, you're probably thinking, well, why not just take it out entirely? Use one of those newfangled genetic editing methods that Campanella keeps talking about, like CRISPR-Cas. Well, Ramalho Santos couldn't do that, unfortunately. You cannot just simply remove line one from a cell. There are thousands of copies. In fact, about 17% of the Human Genetic Instruction Book, the genome, is made up of transposons, not just line one, but lots of others. It turned out that the researchers found that without line one RNA, embryonic stem cells stopped making more of themselves, and mouse embryos failed to progress past the two-cell stage of development. Ramalho Ramos insists the scientists have long suspected that transposons are important for embryonic development. Now, I have never heard this, but for scientists, it's always nice to insist that something was the common belief after you've shown it to be true. You know, everything is clearer in hindsight, right? At any rate, in the study, the team found that RNA copies of the jumping gene team up with two proteins to turn off a gene called DUX, DUX. DUX helps embryos get to the two-cell stage, but having too much of DUX around can hinder embryos from moving around beyond that stage. Line 1 and its protein colleagues also turn on production of key pieces of ribosomes, the protein manufacturing factories of the cell. Stockpiling ribosomes helps embryos churn out proteins needed for the organism to continue growing. Previous work by other scientists has shown that jumping genes have shaped human evolution. I mean, for example, two proteins that help the immune system respond to new pathogens were originally transposon proteins, and some transposon remnants may have been responsible for sculpting the differences between chimpanzee and human faces. All this suggests is that it's important to look beyond genes and even beyond nearby regulatory sites to really start to understand what might be going on in physiology and development at a cellular level. And one more thing, Ramalho Ramos says, quote, "It's still unclear whether line one is as crucial for human development as it seems to be for mice. We just do not know that yet," unquote. Next up, here's a short but interesting story from the Journal of Experimental Biology.
In confrontations, it's usually a good idea to pick on someone your own size. But Dr. Pascal Fossat and his colleagues from the University of Bordeaux, France, injected the neurotransmitter serotonin to crayfish.
Once they did this, they found that the crustaceans that were smaller than their opponents squared up as if ready for a fight, while larger crayfish backed down. As most small animals retreat meekly when faced with a larger adversary, the team compared the responses of individual crayfish to small and large opponents after serotonin injection in order to find out whether the effect of the neurotransmitter on an animal depends on its size. However, the crayfish's responses switched depending on their size relative to their opponent, with medium-sized crayfish backing down when faced with a smaller opponent, while other medium-sized animals picked fights with crayfish that outsized them. Fawcett and his colleagues say, quote, "Our results indicate that the effects of serotonin on aggressiveness are dependent on the perception of the relative size difference of the opponent." The group also suspects that crayfish can evaluate the risk of a confrontation with a larger or smaller opponent in addition to assessing their relative strengths. As the crustaceans were no longer able to accurately gauge themselves relative to their rival after a serotonin injection, the team suggests, quote, "that serotonin is probably able to fine-tune the perception of risk to be taken in response to danger," unquote. And they add that this effect may also occur in other creatures. You may remember my discussion of endless serotonin from a few months back and the music of Mr. Cookie Jar. I said at the time that Mr. Cookie Jar's proposal for endless serotonin would only lead to disaster for the unlucky recipient. I was right then, and I'm right now. Extra serotonin certainly does not appear to be helpful to crayfish in judging opponents. Onwards and upwards. Well, actually, sort of backwards. Let's go back to gender for just a second. So, sharks.
sharks, male sharks, female sharks. But there are hermaphroditic sharks. I mean, they've always existed, just like mammalian hermaphrodites, or hermaphrodites from most species.
Well, it seems that things are changing. Dr. Alyssa Barnes of the Dokshin Foundation in Malaysia reported at the International Marine Conservation Congress last month
that she found a whole slew of apparently male sharks who were just not male. In fact, they were female, and they were pregnant. I am told by my marine biologist colleagues that it's easy to tell a male from a female shark. Flip it over. If it has a pair of claspers, these are finger-like extensions jutting from the end of the pelvic fins, it's male. No claspers mean female. It's sort of like a phallus. Claspers deliver sperm into the female. Alyssa Barnes knew this perfectly well when she dissected 7 big-eye hound sharks with claspers and found a complete female reproductive system in each. None of the 7 sharks had any internal male sex organs, and 6 of the sharks were pregnant. Barnes stumbled upon these hermaphroditic sharks at a port in Odisha in eastern India in 2017. She was surveying local fishers to see if changes in their practices might explain a decline in hauls of sharks and rays. When she checked what the fishing vessels brought in, Barnes noted 2 oddities. Male big-eye hound sharks greatly outnumbered females, and though males of this deepwater species are smaller than females, she saw immature males as large as female adults. Sensing something was amiss, she took some sharks back to her lab for dissection. Says Barnes, quote, "I was so amazed that I squealed during the dissections. Even before opening the fish, I knew there was something odd, because I could feel the pups inside of a supposedly male fish. Hermaphroditism is very uncommon in sharks. Our 7 hermaphrodite sharks are one of the most unusual cases that we have ever heard of." Unquote. With her finds and others like them in the seas around Southeast Asia, Barnes is convinced that there is something going on with the sharks, quote unquote. She suspects it might be pollutants in the water or hormonal changes, human-caused or otherwise, and she is keen to find out. I just want to remind you all about plastics that are becoming more and more ubiquitous in the ocean. A large number of those plastics have xenoestrogen-like properties. It's not that hard of a jump to imagine those alien hormones pushing development of embryonic male sharks away from the norm. We think global warming is a problem? Just wait. If we do not fix these problems with pseudo-hormones messing up the animal reproduction and development on this planet, hot weather and melting ice caps will be the least of our issues. The last story of the night is, well, it's not a biology story, and at least it's not a downer like the last one was. It's kind of cool, and a real first in a couple of ways. Dr. Miriam Kepler of the Max Planck Institute has visually observed the first exoplanet for the first time. Since I have been constantly giving you guys updates on exoplanet searches for the past few years, you know that astronomers have indirectly identified other exoplanets by observing the paths of these worlds cleared through dusty disks around their parent stars and blotting out light. And this goes back to at least 2014, if not longer. However, it's always been indirect. And again, it's by seeing how much light the planets block out from the star. But you never actually see the planet itself. Now, Kepler's picture, which was released July 2nd, of the newly discovered exoplanet dubbed PDS-70b, gives the first clear visual of not just an exoplanet, but a still-forming exoplanet, seen as a bright splotch of light off to the side of its host star. This exoplanet in the making was described in a pair of papers accepted to the journal Astronomy and Astrophysics, and because it's quite visible, it could provide new testing ground for theories of planet formation. Kepler spotted PDS-70b using the Very Large Telescope in Chile, which is a special infrared telescope. Her observations revealed PDS-70b to be a giant cloudy world, about as far from its host star as Uranus is from our sun. But there's still much we don't know about the planet. It could be as cool as 730 degrees Celsius, or as hot as 1330 degrees Celsius. And its mass could be anywhere from twice to even 17 times that of Jupiter. Kepler says, quote, PDS-70b has blazed a trail through the disk of planet-making material around its sun by packing on gas and dust in its orbital path. Best of all, its position inside that empty orbital tract, as well as the age of its star, only 5.4 million years old, indicates that the planet isn't finished forming yet. Unquote. Well, that's all from me. As always, take care. Happy 10th anniversary again. Get those xenoestrogens cleaned up before things get worse. Keep watching the skies, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.